Complications from COVID-19 may depend on von Willebrand factor in the blood. Have you heard about this? The hypothesis goes something like this. Since replication of the virus inside the body leads to microdamage on blood vessel walls, in response, the body releases von Willebrand factor into the blood to start the work of clotting. We know all about this. Well, the result of all this additional von Willebrand factor, due to the microdamage being done, leads to a higher risk of thrombosis, which has been a significant part of the deaths from COVID. So is this true, that the more von Willebrand factor in the system, the more harmful COVID might be? And if it is true, does that mean those of us with deficiencies actually stand to fare better with COVID? We will discuss. And later in the show, NHF education specialist Nicole Scappi, she joins me to preview NHF's virtual BDC and share a bit of her own bleeding disorder and von Willebrand disease journey. All of that and more coming up on this episode, made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. Learn more about Takeda's commitment at bleedingdisorders.com. And hey, welcome to Bloodstream. I'm joined this week by my wife and co-host, in that order, Natalie Lynch. Hello, Natalie.
Hi.
And for the first time as co-host on the Bloodstream podcast, a familiar voice, a new role, a welcomed evolution to the show. Please welcome host Amy Board. Hello, Amy.
Oh my goodness. Hello, Bloodstream listeners. It's me.
It is you. There you are. What is new with you, Amy? Actually, I got to be honest. I'm cheating a little bit. I know something that's new with you that listeners might be interested to hear about.
I turned a very significant age over the weekend. I am in a new decade.
Yeah.
I turned 40. And if you see pictures of me on the internet, you're probably like, oh my God, she looks like she's 12. And that's a thing. That's fine. But I'm 40. Four decades. 4-0. I'm in a new category of boxes that you check on questionnaires. It's a lot.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Is this one of those like leap? Because I started paying attention to that when I got past the one that like started with a one. And it was like, oh, shoot, I'm in like the 27 to 35 now. And I guess now I'm moving on to the next one. Those boxes are a thing, man.
They're a thing. I don't know. It's been my joke. But yeah. It's a new category. But it's good. It's good.
What was it like having the big birthday during COVID?
Well, it was weird, and it wasn't weird until the day. I'm not much of a birthday celebrator, to the horrification of my mother, but I really missed not having people around, and it was lovely. It was really lovely, and my partner, my boyfriend, really went all out, and it was great. And I wanted to swim in the ocean. I have not swam in California waters yet. Actually, I live in LA,
oh,
and
wow.
I've been to the beach. I've actually talked to Natalie about this, since she is a water nerd as well. But I haven't swam in California waters, and I have a water thing. So I was like in the water the whole time, and it was glorious. But I missed people. I wish there could have been, our group of people here. And I'm an introvert, and so I was kind of taken back that I missed people a lot that weekend.
I mean, that sounds like a perfect birthday, swimming in, you know, baptizing yourself in the California waters for your 40th birthday.
Absolutely. I thought of you, Nat. Actually, I was like, Natalie would be into this.
Totally.
We were just talking about this yesterday, though. The longer this goes on and the more it seems as though we may be in this position of, you know, hunkered downness for a while, the life events that are going to take place that we're not going to be with loved ones for. And, you know, we've been starting to think about that a little bit more seriously on this end. Haven't we, Nat? Transition, huh?
Yeah. I mean, certainly a concern about how long this will last, because we'll be having a baby in 7 months. And, you know, that's certainly something we want to, you know, we want this kid to meet people.
That's true. That is one of the things we agreed on earlier. Like, when we have a child, we should introduce the child to other human beings.
Yeah,
up for up to debate, you guys. That's up for debate. I don't know.
As much as we love our little bubble, you know, it's probably best for the mental health of this child to know more than just us.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how long this, as long as this thing is going, not to derail from the baby thing, but to, you know, people are having children and people are, getting married or delaying weddings. We have friends in our circle that are delaying weddings and birthdays. Like, I think everyone's probably going to experience a birthday during this. I mean, it's just this interesting time.
Even funerals too. Like, they're not the same right now. So,
yes.
You know, people yes. can't celebrate people's life, their whole life, you know. Hopefully our baby will be able to celebrate their 40th birthday. Hopefully this doesn't go on for 40 years.
That's our latest hope. We figured if we just get a little more conservative and set a low bar. So our goal is to introduce the child to others by 40. So that's you know, for now. And we'll see how that evolves. But Amy.
Again, other people are the worst. I'm kidding.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
That is a big one. So as someone who kind of appreciates the, not the biggest birthday, kind of introvert, like, yeah, the big ones are a thing. So we're not having that big thing, but we're having a different big thing over here. And yeah, it's like, oh, this is not quite how it's supposed to go. So I feel you.
Exactly. And I feel like your big thing is bigger than my big thing. So congratulations from all of us in the Bloodstream universe. And yeah,
I'm glad.
That's a big deal, you guys. And how fun to have this community rally around you guys. They're going to rally around this kid. It's going to be really fun.
Oh, man, I haven't thought about that too much.
Yep, they're born into a community, built-in community. But I think there's room. I think there's room for all big things.
There is room for all big things. Thank you. Yes, I'm glad you called that back. There's room for all big things. Amongst the big things is, Amy, you're coming over here. It's awesome to now know that you're going to be one of the anchors to the Bloodstream podcast going forward. Later, we are going to preview the virtual BDC, and Nicole's going to come on to talk about that and her own journey as a person with a bleeding disorder and what led her to work at NHF. That's always something I'm interested in when community members go on to work at the foundation. What leads you to that? But we should start here first with this big story that I teased in the preview, that complications from COVID-19 may depend on von Willebrand factor in the blood. So this is a story that came out first on July 6th, or at least that's when I first saw it. And I'm just going to give a bit of context before we get into a discussion. So a senior research associate at a lab in St. Petersburg has advanced this hypothesis that the severe course of COVID-19 may be associated with von Willebrand factor, one of the main components of the blood coagulation system. As the researcher suggests, the replication of the virus stimulates the development of microdamage on vessel walls, and in response, the body releases von Willebrand factor into the blood, trying to patch possible holes. As a result, the risk of thrombosis increases. It is with this clotting that a significant part of the deaths from COVID-19 are associated. So I brought this article up to the HemoFriends group on Facebook to see if anybody else had heard about this, had heard expert input. And I got a lot of responses from several dozen community members and experts. Thank you for those, by the way. I'm going to share some of those in a little bit. But first, I'm just curious to know from you both, Amy, what did you think when you first heard this story?
You know, honestly, I had a bit of a cynical take just because there seems to be many things being said about COVID. And, you know, it's so funny that this is von Willebrand factor. That's in the middle of this, VWD being so complicated and so tricky to nail down in a black and white way in terms of the deficiency and treatment that it would be here interlaced in the conversation of COVID, which is the exact same thing. I mean, this is not black and white. It seems like when you get influenza A, which I have had legitimately influenza A, it's a thing. These are your symptoms, and you know, this is the thing, and COVID is not that way. So I was a bit cynical, just like, ugh, it's just another thing. And the more that I've heard about it, the more that the community has responded to it, it just feels very intriguing to me. I am just interested to hear more voices that are more probably have more authority than mine.
Sure. Yeah, and there's still so much uncertainty around it too. So hearing from more expert voices when there's not really a consensus around what is admittedly here in this article, still a hypothesis, seems really important. Natalie, what stuck out most to you?
I mean, to be honest, learning more about von Willebrand factor, period. Because even though I've been in this community, I feel more knowledgeable about hemophilia A and hemophilia B. And of course, I've heard about von Willebrand factor and von Willebrand disease and had like a cursory knowledge of what that was, but in this article, and not that this article goes into a deep dive, but I was like, oh, okay. Like I just had, it gave me a better understanding period of that, that bleeding disorder. And, also just interest, what I found interesting is it lists, groups of people who have higher natural von Willebrand factor in their blood to begin with. And yeah. those groups are being African-Americans, men, adults over children, elderly over middle aged. And that seems to be the populations who seem to be contracting COVID at higher rates, period, across the board. So not only is this article saying that if you have more factor, potentially your severity and complications from COVID might be worse, but that it almost suggests that these populations that have higher VWF are also the ones that seem slightly more percentage-wise affected.
Or at the very least, because that their experience of COVID is more extreme as a result of increased von Willebrand factor, these are the cases that we are finding, you know, in this time where we're still not diagnosing across the board. So maybe they contract it at the same rate at the same rate as anybody else would, but it presents more severely if you have higher VWF levels. Therefore, in this time of like still not ubiquitous testing, those are the cases that we're finding out about more than just your average case of COVID, if that makes sense.
And I think for clarity, it's if you have a higher level of VWH and you contract COVID, it's because you could, or
what's
symptomatically
VWH?
Von Willebrand factor.
Oh, VWH? H.
What did I say?
VWH.
Can we please keep that in? Please, can we keep it in?
Amy, you are a welcomed, you are very welcomed here. I like your style. That's in. Keep it in.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so what is it? VWF.
It made me think for a second. I was like, oh, shit, I said the wrong thing.
I was like, what part of the article did she
read
that I didn't?
I didn't catch it. I didn't even like think like, oh, that sounds wrong, which is terrible. Thank God for you guys. Hey, everybody. Letters are tricky.
I mean, sometimes when we're doing this podcast, I really feel like it's like Sesame Street. Like this episode of the Bloodstream podcast is brought to you by the letters NHF. By the letters BDC, by the letters VWD.
I feel like that's a healthcare thing. Like the acronyms are, maybe that's not even a healthcare thing. Maybe it's like an American thing. Like we need to knock it off with the acronyms.
I've also felt like, so we, the 30th anniversary of the Ryan White Care Act passed this year. And, you know, so that's a bill I know a bit about. So the CARE Act and the relief bills from COVID that the government has passed, they have been CARES, and like it always stands for something. And then it's like, we got the HERO bill. Every bill has an acronym where it's made out to sound like somebody is accomplishing something extraordinary. And then the stretching done to make the acronym work is where the real art of policymaking comes in. But I think we digress just a wee bit. You were making a good clarifying point. Go ahead.
I was going to make a very fancy point, and now I feel terrified to say it. VWF. So if you have elevated levels of von Willebrand factor and you contract COVID, you have a higher chance of clotting a little bit. And I think that's, at least that was my understanding of this article. And that in itself causes, you know, obviously something to be looked at, and you could have higher risk of certain things. You could have clots in your lungs and those types of things. So I think, anyway, I just wanted to clarify that that's was my understanding of what they are starting to look at.
And as you just said, starting to look at, and we're making it's a hypothesis. This has not been proven out in tests. It's just one of the many, many, many things that people are looking at, researchers are looking at, and trying to better understand COVID and its complications and its various iterations. So I mentioned the community feedback and the Hemo Friends page. And in addition to there being like a lot of community members, some of these community members are also themselves clinicians and experts and scientists and researchers. So it's quite a good diverse group. It does seem like the consensus is if there is any significance, those with lower levels of von Willebrand factor do stand to do a little bit better during COVID, but it's still just a theory and shouldn't like meaningfully change anyone's behavior. It in no way makes you immune to it. Or so it's like, if anything, a mildly decent little bit of news, but it's more likely just something that we should not, or not more likely, but it is more so something we shouldn't pay too much attention to. There was a doctor who did a presentation for the New England Hemophilia Association on COVID and bleeding and presented some slides and some information. I was thinking about going through that, but I think we've kind of made the important points, and instead we'll include some links and some posts on social media with screen grabs and language. So if you want to get more into the weeds on this, check us out on our Facebook page and we'll post stuff there for you. But I did at least appreciate that, I guess kind of in way of summary, if anything, it's a little bit of good news in the COVID era about what it might mean to have a bleeding disorder. It's like, if anything, it might be okay. I did appreciate that. That's not usually how the story goes. So that was one of my takeaways.
Yeah, I was just kind of going back to what Amy was saying about influenza A and the symptoms being very like prescriptive.
Yeah.
And with this, you know, at first they're saying this is COVID, you know, and then they're like, oh, but you might have diarrhea too, but you might not. And so I feel like the more research that's coming out now and that there being problems with vascular systems, and like the vascular system runs through your entire body, through every organ, it makes sense that this is presenting differently in different people. If like the complications are caused by a vascular thing. I don't know, that just came up and I just wanted to throw that in before we wrapped up this article.
And another thought that I have, community members, if you have been affected by COVID in this experience, I would love to hear from you. We would love to hear your experience. It'd be really interesting to see, you know, if your symptoms have been less severe, but also just your experience. I think that would be welcome on the podcast. So I'll just do an open call to action there. If you want to contact us, you can find us on social media. You can also find us at mailbag@bloodstreaminfo.com.
Yeah, good call. Bloodstreammedia.com, bloodstreaminfo on the socials. But if you're sending an email, mailbag.
Brutal.
At bloodstreammedia.
Man, I have really blown
Amy,
it.
Amy, you are excellent. And the important stuff was communicated. Plus, people are more likely to remember it now anyway. Great call to action. Glad you said that. We are interested. So do let us know. info@bloodstreammedia.com or @bloodstreaminfo on the socials. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to do an overview of the virtual BDC taking place August 1 through 8th on the internet. We'll be right back.
So I just want to give a quick shout out to William Addison. He is a teen in the bleeding disorders community. I believe he has hemophilia A, and he is hiking the Appalachian Trail for Save One Life.
Go, Will.
Yeah. He had an initial goal of $2,200, and he has since then doubled that goal because he surpassed his initial goal. So his current goal is $4,400, and he's currently at $4,011. So,
oh, that's close.
Yeah, so close. Let's get him there, guys.
How do we go? Where do we go?
I don't know. But I'm assuming the Save One Life website has something on it, and as a board member, I should know. But I feel like if you Google William Addison, Save One Life, Appalachian Trail, put some pluses in there, you'll find it. And we'll put that information in the program notes, since I'm obviously not well prepared to share that.
I think you did perfectly. Thanks, Natalie. And go, Will. So we kind of went quickly past something earlier that I'm going to come back to now, which is that Natalie and I are pregnant and 10 weeks pregnant, and life's a bit different than it used to be. And I wanted Natalie to give you a chance. I know there's a lot of, I mean, I think in general, it's a life event people are kind of interested in, but there's a lot of moms out there too. And there's a lot of people who I think would be curious to hear a little more from you about what this experience has been like 10 weeks in.
Yeah, well, it is, I will be a first time mom. So that's exciting. And yeah, also just considering what it means to be a mom in the bleeding disorders community now, because I am not a carrier, and because we're presuming Patrick's the dad.
Fingers crossed, guys.
That our daughters will be carriers and our sons will not have hemophilia. And interestingly enough, you know, I am in some groups on Facebook, and I think there still is some like confusion around how hemophilia is passed down and what that genetic box or tree looks like. Sometimes I see it and I'm like, oh, you know, everyone's on a different learning curve and meet people where they are. But I'm just surprised sometimes when I see people's understanding of how genetics work in the bleeding disorders community. So married to someone who is a wonderful person, living a full life with hemophilia, I would not be scared or worried. Not saying I wouldn't be worried to have a kid with a bleeding disorder, but that, you know, knowing that our sons will not have it and our daughters will be carriers, what does that mean? And what does that mean for the birth experience? And as a doula, considering what my birth options are, and I've attended births at hospitals, I've attended births at birth centers, I've attended births at home. So I've had a chance to kind of see what birth looks like in many different settings. And I think it's 100% a personal choice, depending on how risk averse you are, depending on how knowledgeable you are, and how comfortable you are to make the choice that's right for you. And for me, birthing at home is the correct choice at this point. And I think that I am open to getting more information around, that experience from my own pregnancy, from, you know, learning, but right now that's the choice that, we're making. And my one concern was if we did have, a girl and, she was a symptomatic carrier, would the risks to birthing at home be increased? The bleeding risks, that is.
Right. And so we asked actually a fair number of hematologists and did our fair share of consulting. And for me, just to speak to about my process and comfortability, I needed to hear from a few different people that that would be a responsible choice to make before feeling comfortable, and was really happy to hear like, oh, no, this is a totally responsible choice to make in our circumstance, and I can now very comfortably lean into that. So, and then it's been fun too how that affects the thoughts about gender, and you know, we're making the choice to not find out, and the speculation is fun. And then, you know, the speculation into a boy, we know, barring just random genetic mutation, that hemophilia wouldn't be a part of it. And we know that if it's a girl, there's a chance it will. You know, there's a 50-50 chance in one way or another it will. And what does that mean in 2020 in America and for us? So it's just, it's interesting to think about. We should mention to people that your availability for the podcast over time is likely to change too as a result of this new responsibility coming into your life, as well as some other stuff going on too. But that we will be checking in with you pretty often about how life as an expecting mother is going here on the Bloodstream podcast. So thanks for your willingness to keep us posted on your journey as it goes.
Yeah, I'm really happy to keep the community up to date on what's going on. And I just think the journey's fun. It's fun to follow people's pregnancies. It's fun to hear about, you know, just what it is, because it is so different for every woman. And even as a woman, every pregnancy is different. So I have to say, so far, so good, 10 weeks. I did have a medical scare, which I think I'll tease here. Everything's fine, but I'd love to talk more about it on the next episode in A Moment for Motherhood about my own bleeding episode. So I'll leave that there with the caveat that I'm okay right now and baby's okay, but what that experience was like for me.
Wow. The content producer in me is so proud of you right now. That was very well done. Good tease. And I am glad that you're fine. So that being said, let's move into talking a bit about the virtual BDC coming up August 1 through 8. We've spent some time, the three of us, looking at the program's interactive platform, which is really simple to use. So you can easily search by day, by time frame, like I'm a consumer, I'm a provider, I'm a spouse, and kind of break the program down according to what your experience that you want. So We'll have a link to the platform itself in the program notes. You can also find it by going to hemophilia.org and following the flashing banners that lead you toward the BDC. Amy, are there some sessions that stuck out to you in particular, and why?
Yeah, it's a good program, I think, overall. And the sessions that stood out to me that I think might be of interest. There is a session August 1st, about the insurance market and evaluating your choices in such a changing insurance market. And we are savvy consumers here in the bleeding disorder community, and you guys know better than I do even to stay up to date. And so that one stood out to me as just a must. Whether you're secure, you feel secure in your insurance or not, everything changes so quickly. And we have such tremendous experts on that end of the spectrum working with us. So to check that one out, August 1st. There are a few sessions actually about specific cultures in the bleeding disorder community. There's a session about Asian and Pacific Islander cultures and bleeding disorders. There's a session about Western Asia and Muslim cultures and bleeding disorders. There's one about African Americans. And those stood out to me as new offerings, and the speakers look terrific. And in our current climate as a country, I think regardless if you feel those would be very good to sit in on. Another session that I loved, the title, it made me laugh, Demystifying the Iliopsoas, the Boogeyman of All Muscle Bleeds, that made me laugh. It's a provider session, it's a PT session, but you know, iliopsoas bleeds are oh man, there.
Yeah, can you give people like the 30-second overview of why this is the thing?
Well, the iliopsoas is such a huge muscle, so if you get a bleed in that sucker, and it's kind of like your butt. I mean, it's like it is your butt. You can't sit. It is painful, and it's hard to treat and to rest. And I've had a couple friends that have told me, like, I'm more afraid of an iliopsoas bleed than I am for like an inhibitor or something, because they're just gnarly. And I don't know, I've never seen, and you know, maybe this is just me being naive, but I've never seen a session dedicated to the iliopsoas. And so if I was a bleeder, I would go to that session.
I want to go to that session.
It sounds great.
Also, totally. I'm fascinated with the psoas as a muscle in general. And I imagine why it's such a complicated bleed too, is it's the only muscle in the body that inserts in the back, and it originates in the back, and the insertion is in the femur. So it loops through your pelvis. So it inserts in the lumbar, the vertebral column. And then it wraps around your spine, and then it comes in your pelvis, and then it inserts to the top of the femur. So not only does it affect the top of the legs, the butt, the hips, but also the lower back. Like, that's probably why it's a gnarly, gnarly bleed.
Awesome. So, Natalie, you should go to that session. It sounds like you'd have some stuff to add.
I always sneak into the PT sessions. I love them. They're so interesting to me as a yoga teacher and as someone who's really fascinated with the body in those ways. And then, like, people have never kicked me out. And I'm just sitting around being like, oh, I don't think I have the right tags to be in here.
And I would say that in most, at least in my experience at the BDC, when you go in person, you can go to those provider sessions and they won't kick you out. Like, you can just sit there in the back. But the coolest thing, if you feel self-conscious, this virtual situation, you can just go and just listen. Just a nice invitation for all of us to go to some of these very heady sessions.
For sure, for sure. Was there any other ones that you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, there's a last one. It's on August 6th. And this is the one I'm most excited about, and I'm excited for you guys to maybe be involved in it, because the meeting at BDC typically for this topic is closed, and it's not this year. It's like an hour and a half, and it's with a collaborative that was put together by NHF. It's called the Comprehensive Care Sustainability Collaborative, the CCSC. And it was put together by the policy team. And it is a collaborative. It is a committee that is made up of the majority insurance payers. It's with NHF policy experts, HTC clinicians, physicians and payers. And this collaborative works behind the scenes to ensure access for our community. This collaborative, in my humble opinion, is going to be a huge conversation in terms of how we get gene therapy paid for. In fact, guaranteed that that's what they are diving into. The session is called Forging New Ground to Meet the Evolving Needs of Patients, and it's open for everybody, and I would highly recommend going and listening. This will be your opportunity to hear from payers, and Patrick made a great point when we were talking about it earlier, that it will be such a almost like a little gem in your pocket to hear how payers think, how they talk, where they come from. I think one of the greatest things that NHF has taught me, the policy team has taught me, is that they aren't necessarily coming from a bad place. It's just understanding their why they make the decisions they need to make so we can strategize how best to work with them. And from my chair, in terms of how we best go forward with ensuring access for our community, for all treatments, to what each family, each patient, how they want to be treated, is this type of relationships with payers at the right level. And NHF is working behind the scenes to do this. And it would just, I think, behoove the majority of us to listen in on that conversation.
Yeah, that was really well said. I can co-sign, nothing to particularly add. I just endorse everything you just said. It was one of the most eye-opening sessions for me to be a part of years ago. What about for you, Natalie? What stuck out on this list as a partner, as a spouse? What did you see for yourself there? Not that that's the only way you identify.
I have a lot of identifications. But in this community, yes, I identify as a partner and a spouse. So in the partner-spouse track, there are two. We have one on the 1st from 1:50 p.m. to 2:35 p.m. Eastern Standard Time called Battle of the Sexes, Sex and Relationships. And then there's one on the 8th from 2:40 p.m. to 3:25 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Running on Empty, Couples Compassion Fatigue. And the group, the Compassion Fatigue one, is led by Kathy Teagues, who I sat in on. She did one last year, too. Social worker from Cleveland, which just stuck with me in my brain, being from Cleveland. But yeah, I mean, I'm a little surprised that that's all the offerings for spouses and partners. And, you know, I hope that because there's only a couple, that they're well attended and that the information is good. And that, you know, I think what feels important in these sessions to receive is people are coming hungry for tools for their toolbox, and not necessarily to like sit around and like, you know, I think people want to know how other people are managing compassion fatigue, how other people are managing sex in their relationship. You know, so my hope for these sessions is that they, that people walk away with some tools. Yeah. So I'm excited to see what they're like this year.
And, you know, I'll add to that, too, to the point you made, Natalie, about maybe with there being fewer sessions, to be precise, that they'll be better attended. I'm fairly certain of this. I was on a call with some folks from NHF earlier about one of the sessions that I'm about to speak to. So I'm pretty sure this is true, but I'm not 1,000%. The sessions will be available through the online platform through August 30th. So I believe so long as you're registered for the conference, if you do miss a session or if you want to go back, you should be able to access them for a few weeks following the conference. Again, I'm not 1,000% sure of that, but I feel pretty confident about that. The two things that I'll point out selfishly are the things that Believe Limited has been responsible for. So for the 6th year, the Teen Impact Awards is a big kickoff event every year, and it is even in this virtual format. So on Sunday the 2nd at 6:30 Eastern Standard will be the 6th annual Teen Impact Awards. We will honor 58 community teens for the impact they're making in homes, schools, and community around the country. And we will give out the first three $1,000 scholarships for in Adam Lynch's memory for leaders who are pursuing higher education in one way or another. So the very first year we're going to be awarding the Adam Lynch scholarships, which will live on through the National Hemophilia Foundation following this BDC. So that is pretty cool. Sunday the 2nd, 6:30 Eastern Standard Time, the Teen Impact Awards. And we had a lot of fun creating the program for that. So I promise you'll at least giggle once, at least once in the time that you're there. On Friday the 7th at 7, I really like that because it's easy. Friday the 7th at 7 Eastern is something we've been working on with a bunch of different partners now for quite a while. As part of the I'm Not Okay opening up about mental health session, that session actually features the Let's Talk documentary that Believe Limited has produced over the past year, where we dip into the lives of five different members of our community to learn how they have found strength through their struggle and to hear about very different types of experiences with mental challenges related to and unrelated to life with a bleeding disorder in the house. These are really compelling, some of the most honest stuff that I have seen us capture, which is a silly kind of sentence to say, but there are just moments in that film that I've watched, and I mean, obviously I'm very, very biased. I didn't direct the film. I was never on set. I'm one of the producers. But there are moments watching the edit where I was like, I don't know if I've ever seen this level of raw sharing about this topic before, which is a really cool experience to have as a producer. So I would highly encourage anybody to come to that session again, Friday the 7th at 7 Eastern. I'm Not Okay, opening up about mental health featuring Let's Talk. And there's a panel as well with Debbie De La Riva and a few other social workers and mental health experts that will follow the film. And then lastly, oh, I'm wearing my shirt, the Science Fair. So last year at the BDC in the exhibition hall, we had about 3,500 square feet that were reserved for our first iteration of the Believe Limited Science Fair, five modules helping explain and teach the science behind bleeding and clotting, the treatments that have been made available, and where we seem to be headed scientifically. We expanded this year to include some special modules and virtual poster boards on the hemophilia B experience, von Willebrand disease, rare factor experiences, women with bleeding disorders, and a lot more. We've got videos on treatments all from the 1950s up and through emicizumab and a look ahead to gene therapy. So it is a super comprehensive experience that we have digitized, virtualized, did everything we needed to do to make it a part of the virtual BDC experience. And the Science Fair will be open during exhibit hall hours all throughout the conference. There'll be a number of times where clinicians will be available live to answer questions. In fact, I believe during one of those slots, NHF CEO Dr. Len Valentino will be on hand to field questions from people who are coming through the science fair. So you can check that out in the exhibit hall. That's not going to come up in the program quite the same way as the traditional sessions do, but all of that's available on NHF's website. Again, hemophilia.org. You can follow the banners, and we'll put a link to the program, the interactive platform that is, into the program notes. All right, that was pretty robust, y'all. I think we did a good job. Let us now get to the interview with Nicole to hear from her about the virtual BDC and her journey with VWD. Oh, hey there. Did you know that the Bloodstream Podcast is made possible by Takeda? That's true, and you probably did know that. But I'm here to remind you that at bleedingdisorders.com, you can learn exactly what Takeda is doing to help support the bleeding disorders community. Again, that is bleedingdisorders.com. And for your support of the Bloodstream Podcast, as always, we like to say, thanks, Takeda. Joining me now for the interview is NHF Education Specialist Nicole Scappi. Good morning and good afternoon, Nicole. How you doing?
Good afternoon, Patrick. I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. Excited to be here today. So thank you again for inviting me to be a part of the podcast today.
Of course. Well, it's a very NHF BDC driven and focused time. So I thought it might be nice for listeners to hear from you and hear a little bit about what's been happening at NHF in the run up to this and to actually start there. It was announced what seems like only a couple days ago, although I suppose at this point it was several weeks ago, but not that long ago, that the conference once intended for Atlanta, Georgia over a weekend was going to move to a virtual conference an entire week long and actually start earlier than originally anticipated. So what, take us back to those conversations in June, maybe in May, or I don't even know when they started. What was NHF discussing as the debate started on whether or not to postpone, cancel, move, make virtual the Bleeding Disorders Conference?
Sure. So just from observance as well, I was able to see between senior staff and Len that immediately they began to just learn about COVID first. And then they kind of started their planning from there, as there was just so much uncertainty. But one thing I do know, that they weren't willing to risk it all with the safety of our community. So during all of that as well, is that our Commerce and Travel Services team and other departments started looking into different options on how we can convert the meeting virtually, but without losing the quality and the engagement, right? So now we were actually able to do that, and we have all these amazing sessions with different community members from across the world that everyone has access to for free, especially community members. So whenever anyone does, and hopefully I see you all there, you can participate. You can ask questions to our speakers during the live and the pre-recorded sessions. So I think that we were able to make this into a pretty epic experience.
Yeah, it's neat how the virtual adaptation does make new opportunities available, like you mentioned, bringing in international speakers who were at the Live Atlanta originally conceived iteration would not have been a part of it. So that's a neat opportunity. Is there anything that you are particularly personally excited about at BDC this year?
I am. So I'm torn between two things. So I obviously have some really great sessions, but in addition, I'm excited for a new experience of Camp Unite. So Camp Unite is a virtual camp that NHF will be hosting, and it's inviting youth from all over the country who have a bleeding disorder or whose siblings have a bleeding disorder. And you're a camp guy, Patrick. You know that, you know, kid, you go into your bunk when you go to camp. So we're really going to try to create that feeling that you feel at camp with, like, the bonding and the community, but just in a virtual environment. So some of the things that the kids can do is obviously have those live meetups, but they're going to be given some self-paced projects, and they're going to be given some challenges each day. So it's a really good balance of, you know, having programming, but also letting them do things on their own, because we realize that people cannot be on screens all day. And camp was something that my team and I wanted to absolutely make happen. And we are very grateful that Takeda stepped up and was able to fund camp for us. So I really do encourage everyone, 6 to 17, to register for camp. You can do so by going to hemophilia.org and looking at our programs page. And do so by July 19th, because that is the last day to register if you want to receive a camp box full of funds.
Awesome. And yes, to echo that, thank you to Takeda for stepping up for that, because camp is such an important part of the community fabric. And to the point that you made about when you get into the bunk and that day one, that energy, that vibe, that feeling that you have at camp, well, we can't replicate that lock, stock, and barrel. What is the expression? Something, something, something else? I don't know. While we can't replicate that exactly, we can create that community online. We can create an experience online that mirrors many of the best elements of camp. I know camps around the country have been having to be creative that way this year. We've done that with Breaking Through, having to take what was our 3-day weekend workshop, and it became a 4-month every weekend virtual experience that is like just ending. So my brain is sort of still spinning from that. You did just mention some registration information, at least as it pertained to Camp Unite. For anyone who's interested in registering or looking at the agenda, just learning more about BDC, what's the best place they can go?
Sure. The best place they can go is to hemophilia.org. And on the homepage, on our banner, it'll just keep flashing and it'll say the conference. You could click on that and it'll take you directly to registration.
Okay. Couldn't be much easier. So hemophilia.org, the banner that's blinking at you and saying conference, click that and follow the links. We'll also have a link to hemophilia.org in the program notes. Nicole, as I mentioned at the top, you are an education specialist with NHF. Can you tell people how long you've been associated with the foundation and what got you started there in the first place?
Absolutely. So it's pretty crazy. I've been associated with NHF for over 15 years now, and I just can't believe I can actually, first of all, say that. But well, I guess how I kind of got associated was when I was younger, I was in and out of the emergency room quite consistently. And basically, I was always in casts and getting little fractures. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And then I finally found out I actually wasn't having fractures. I was having bleeding. And this happened about at the age of 13. So I went about 13 years without a diagnosis. And leading to that diagnosis, my mom is a nurse, and she was actually working one day, and she had a lot of bruises on the top of her thighs, and she was scared that she had leukemia. And one of the physicians that she just happened to see on her floor saw all the bruising on her, and they told her to get tested for something called von Willebrand disease. And like, sure thing, my mom went and got tested. She tested positive. All of my siblings tested positive as well. So I ended up getting a diagnosis, but for me, like, that might be like relieving to some folks, but for me, it was really frustrating because I realized that I had this disorder I don't know anything about. But then I went to camp, and then that kind of dropped me right into the avoiding disorders world. And I think that during that point in life, I was in a very selfish space. But if you can imagine with me, Patrick, a teenager with lots and lots of bronzer on her face, and a teen that had to change her clothes every 2 hours and check herself in the mirror to make sure she looked great, right? So that was like me going into my camp experience. And the camp that I went to, it was called Camp Hemavon. And there I learned so much about how materialistic things are irrelevant and not truly take things for granted, because that camp was a little bit different from just the bleeding disorders camp. It was a camp for not only kids with bleeding disorders, but also cancer. And so spending that week with folks with not only bleeding disorders, but cancer as well, just totally changed my perspective. Like, I came there worried about my Abercrombie clothing, my Hollister stuff, and my new friends were worried about coming back alive next year. And so it really just put things into perspective for me, right? And that's pretty much the catalyst that sent me down this road. So I turned what I learned outward rather than inward, and it kind of turned into how can I get involved and make a difference, and led me to participating with chapters. And once I got a taste of the community, I was like, I'm never leaving. I want to know what I can do.
You know, I always look back on my camp time, and I'm very thankful that I went to a camp that wasn't just for kids with hemophilia or bleeding disorders, but all kinds of life-threatening chronic illnesses, as it was labeled. And the downside to that is I didn't learn self-infusion techniques in the way that hemophilia-specific camps that have big stick type sessions and nurse educators there on hand to help with exactly that. Didn't get that. So that's a downside. But I, like you, was exposed at a very young age to what illness could look like outside of what just I had, and saw so many different experiences. And though it's as much as the camper, as the counselors and the programs and all kinds of things at camp influenced me over the years, nothing more profoundly than just being with other campers who had other medical challenges, but were at this place having fun, challenging themselves by choice, supporting one another, and just committing to this environment where our limits were not what defined us. And that is, that to me is invaluable. So I'm very thankful that I went to a camp that, like yours, had a bit of a broader perspective. I think it helped me develop in ways that I'm very grateful for. Did you know education was where this work for you would lead, or how did education become your niche?
Right. So, well, I guess as far as like education, I was in the National Youth Leadership Program. And I had the ability through that program to kind of like test the different waters and see all the different departments at NHS, because I kind of always knew I wanted to work at NHS. But by being an NYLI, one thing I got to do was travel the country and speak and do presentations to different chapters and speak with families from all over the world, and making those connections and like just telling a parent that it's going to be okay and that their kid will come out ultimately stronger, and this bleeding disorder isn't something you should look at as a burden. Just to see the relief in their face, to see someone who is like a bit older tell them that like there might be some struggles, but it will be okay. I just like I love showing people that there's resources and there's educational tools to get you up to speed to where you need to be to help you.
This is probably an impossible question to answer on some level, but how has COVID impacted NHF's work and mission and our community, really? And I say that also cognizant that coming into this year, both at NHF and at HFA, the two national organizations, we had CEOs 10 plus years who were stepping down, new leadership coming in. This pandemic then hits. We're also in an election year, which is not irrelevant. There's all of these like moving pieces that you have to, as an organization, still have like mission, goals, values, objectives, tactics, and strategies. You can't just say everything's changing. We can't do anything. But how? So I guess I'll come back to this impossible question. How has COVID impacted NHF's ability to execute its mission and the community in general from your standpoint?
Yeah, from my point of view, I think the biggest thing that is it stopped all of our in-person events. And I think one of the best parts of this community is those connections that we make with one another in person. I think 100% being in this virtual world has changed that dynamic completely. However, I think the biggest thing I do know is that one thing COVID has not stopped is NHF's momentum to serve the community. I think if anything, it's honestly made us think a little bit more outside the box and how we can best serve the community. So in a way, it's kind of Yeah, I don't want to say COVID is a blessing, but it also has helped us as an organization grow and really like focus on our community members.
Is there any specific example of that in action that comes to mind? Something that COVID has taught you that's like, oh, I'm actually thankful to have learned about this thing?
That's a good question. I don't know. What is one thing? I guess one thing it's taught me is it doesn't mean things stop and that you always just continue to move forward and figure out the next option. It kind of reminds me of campus, like things never go as planned, and COVID is not, like, this isn't going as planned. So you just have to be able to kind of work and jump on your feet and make things happen and go with the flow.
Yeah. I used to say, actually, it's funny when you're describing, like, I had bronzer on my face and I had to change my outfit every 2 hours. You know, when I was a camp counselor, I'd spend half my summer in the boys' cabins and half the summer in the girls' cabins. And I had, that just evokes very specific, like, you're changing again. Like, we're going to the waterfront. We're going fishing and boating. Why are you changing again? But the thing I used to always tell myself, especially as the summer would drag on, and in particular, there was a summer where I was a head counselor of 13, 14-year-old girls. So there were limitations on how much, obviously, personal care I can do as a male counselor. So we're down a staff member. We had people who were sick. We just had, like, everything stacked against us every day, it felt like. And I would wake up in the morning, and I would tell myself every morning, today is going to be an amazing day. I just don't know how or why. And it was like, but we're starting from the premise of, I know there's supposed to be a thunderstorm. I know Allie is not coming back for 2 weeks because she just came out to her dad and he disowned her. I know this person's in quarantine because they just came down with the flu. I know this volunteer is a first timer, so she can't do any personal care for the, I know this person over here, but today is going to be a great day. And these two want to strangle each other every time we turn our back on them, and somehow they're roommates, but today is going to be a great day. And how that attitude really is kind of what makes all the difference in those circumstances. And you're right. Like, it's not, I learned that lesson at camp, but that's not a camp exclusive lesson. That's just a life lesson about adaptation and mindset, really. I think when we met, you were a member of NYLI, which you mentioned being a part of a little while ago. That was maybe 2013, 14, something like that. So just thinking about the last 6-7 years, while you've had this leadership role with this with the Institute and now this professional position as an education specialist, what would you say has been the most encouraging advancement in the treatment and care of bleeding disorders in one way or another since you really started this leadership work?
That's a big and great question, but I think I'm ready to answer that one. I've been thinking a lot about this, and honestly, what came to my mind immediately was the VWD guidelines. I just remember, like, 10 years ago, I was on the Victory for Women committee, and I remember, like, being in a room, and we were just so far back than we are today. And I just fast forward 10 years later, and, like, these guidelines are going to come out, and they are going to help the world. And providers and patients, and it's just been something that we've been waiting so long for, and I feel like so many patients can finally get the validation they're needing. And, you know, as far as management and the diagnosis panel, I think that there's both highlights in each of them. So I think I'm really excited for that one, and we do actually have a session at the conference on these guidelines as well, but because my notes disappeared, I don't have the, oh, actually, they're right in front of my face. But the session on the VWD guidelines is actually going to be August 8th from 4:15 to 5 p.m. So I highly encourage folks to come and just learn a little bit about what those are and the process that's happening. And I'm just so interested in it, and I can't wait to just see them come out.
Yeah, that was a pretty, I remember when first starting to hear about those guidelines and the global effort to come up with a ubiquitously adopted set of guidelines for this really challenging to wrap arms around diagnosis of von Willebrand disease. Or it's not really a diagnosis so much as it is an umbrella of diagnoses. But that is a much larger conversation for a different interview. Nicole, as we're just about to wrap up, coming up on our time here, is there anything else either about the BDC this year or your work at NHF in this year of COVID and uncertainty, or in thinking about the future of von Willebrand disease? I mean, I don't want to brush past the fact that you said earlier how you were experiencing what were believed to be fractures for so long, only to learn, oh, it's actually these bleeds and not having a diagnosis. And now we're talking about these guidelines that are a very big deal. So there have been some extraordinary things that have happened. So there's a lot to choose from, I guess. But is there anything that you're thinking about that we haven't touched on that would be worth sharing with our audience before we wrap up?
I don't know if it's specifically programmatic, but I just want to encourage everyone to stay connected. I know that it gets so hard and we all get like Zoom overload and we're just exhausted with it. But I just think it's important to continue to reach out to the people in the community that you would have reached out to if you were in person. And just building, maintaining those relationships, calling, checking on your friends, see how they're doing, because everybody is dealing with this situation that we're all facing a little bit differently. And I think that just even checking in with someone makes a big difference, and trying to stay positive through all this as well. I think it can be really hard when, you know, you see the news every day or social media kind of gets fueled. And I think just trying to be optimistic and staying strong is something this community does well. And then I hope everyone can continue to do until we're back in person again.
And until we're back in person again, the virtual BDC is here for you coming up August 1st through, is it the 8th or the 9th, Nicole, offhand? I don't recall now.
It is the 1st through the 8th, and it is free to all community members and consumers. And they're also, we'll have an exhibitor's virtual booth as well. So if you want to go visit those as well, I think that would be a great idea too.
Nicole, thank you for your time. We will see you at the virtual BDC.
Oh, thank you so much, Patrick, again, for having me, and I look forward to seeing you virtually.
Thank you once again to Nicole, the education specialist, one of the education specialists from the National Hemophilia Foundation, and that personal preview of the virtual BDC and some insight into her story and reason for doing the work that she does. Amy, once again, welcome and thank you for being a part of the Bloodstream podcast. We're honored to have you here as an anchor of this show going forward.
So excited to be here. So excited.
Natalie, appreciate you as always being a part of this and finding a way forward as life does present some new challenges and opportunities.
Of course. And yeah, I'll keep growing with Bloodstream as I keep growing.
Very well. And thank you to all of you out there who are listening. I should mention we are going to be back on Monday, August 10th. So that is the Monday following the BDC. Amy, Natalie, and I will be back with a wrap-up that we'll record toward the tail end of the BDC. So hear from us next on Monday, August 10th. And with that, that is all for this episode. A reminder to check the program notes for all of the critical information, links, and so forth featured in this episode. Thanks, as always, to our presenting sponsor, Takeda, bleedingdisorders.com, to learn more about them fellas and their commitment to the bleeding disorders community. info@bloodstreammedia.com. Did you get that, Amy? That's what I get for trying to give you a dig. It's mailbag. mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com, @bloodstreaminfo on the social medias. Until next time, my name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And I am Amy Board.
Podcast is produced and edited by Greg Holdsman. Thanks to everybody at Believe Limited. And we will speak to you again on August 10th. Bye, everybody. So I got to admit, when you first... For the first two and a half minutes off mic that you were talking about Captain America and how much Captain America is doing for America right now with such sincerity, and him and his partners and how so great it is, I was trying to figure out how a cartoon from the 90s was saving the world in 2020. And it wasn't until you literally said Chris Evans that my brain, sophisticated as it may be, was able to figure out that you saying Chris Captain America meant the actor who plays him in the billion-dollar global franchise hits, just to make that point.
You know what? But that's on me. That's on me. I literally would... I am never not going to call Chris Evans Captain America. And he is a wonderful, not only is he a wonderful humanitarian that we've just figured out, he's a wonderful human, and he's a phenomenal actor at other things other than Captain America. He will always be Captain America to me, and it's just a joke that's in my vernacular, and so that's on me. I should have been way more clear, but I've never called him Chris Evans, like, never, ever.